Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Deanne Penn with UN News. Climate change is among the greatest threats to the world's monuments and sites, with 1 in 3 natural sites and 1 in 6 cultural heritage sites at risk from wildfires, floods, storms, and other impacts. That's the message from the UN Educational and Cultural Agency, UNESCO, on Monday, the International Day for Monuments and Sites. Foreshadowing some of the potential degradation and losses, the agency warned that some 60% of World Heritage forest sites are facing pressures from climate change. UNESCO is working with countries and communities to help them prepare for and recover from climate-related impacts and disasters, underlining the critical need for stronger collaboration and enhanced monitoring. Over 100 staff and consultants from the World Health Organization, WHO, were deployed in Ethiopia as part of the second round of a vaccination campaign to protect millions of young children from polio amid an outbreak of the disease. The 3-day campaign kicked off on Friday and marked the second phase of inoculations with the new type 2 novel oral polio vaccine, or NOPV2, following an initial round last October. WHO has described the vaccine as a critical new tool in the fight against circulating vaccine-derived poliovirus. The Africa region was certified wild polio-free 2 years ago, but vaccine-derived poliovirus continues to circulate in underserved communities. The campaign targeted more than 16 million children under 5 in all regions of Ethiopia except the capital, Addis Ababa, and the Afar and Tigray regions in the north. It will be carried out in these locations at later dates. In more news from WHO, the agency's chief, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, will be in India this week for the groundbreaking ceremony for the WHO Global Center for Traditional Medicine. The center aims to harness the power of science to strengthen the evidence base for traditional medicine, which includes ancient practices such as acupuncture, Ayurvedic medicine, and herbal mixtures used by millions across the globe. While in Southeast Asia, Tedros will also travel to Nepal, which has launched the first typhoid immunization campaign in the region for children aged 15 months to 15 years. His visit falls ahead of World Immunization Week, observed annually during the last week of April, and he will stop at one of the typhoid vaccination sites. Tedros is also expected to visit the COVID genome sequencing facility established last year in Nepal with WHO support, in addition to meeting with government leaders. Deanne Penn, UN News.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a longtime reporter at Philadelphia's WPVI-TV since the 1960s remembered in his early days spending shifts just listening to a police scanner, waiting for a crime to happen. The station's decision to adopt a then-novel action news format dictated that hyper-focus on crime. But, as detailed in a new report from the Philadelphia Inquirer, it also dictated that the scanner being monitored was in Kensington, a multiracial working-class neighborhood struggling with poverty and its attendant ills, and not someplace else. Lights, Camera, Crime is an early installment of the Inquirer's A More Perfect Union project, aimed at examining the roots and branches of racism in U.S. institutions, including media institutions. The story was reported by Layla A. Jones. We'll speak to Layla Jones today on Counterspin. That's coming up, but first a look back at some recent press. President Biden nominated Gigi Sohn to the FCC last October to fill a Democratic seat vacant since January of 2021. So why hasn't she been confirmed yet? Advocates suspect the corporate media lobby is trying to sink the nomination of the longtime consumer advocate. Sohn would take the fifth seat at the FCC, which is right now deadlocked with two Democratic and two Republican appointees. Without a fifth member, the agency is largely non-functional, which is just peachy for the corporations it's meant to regulate. The stalled nomination has gotten remarkably little press, with the notable exception of the Wall Street Journal, which has run three editorials and an op-ed warning that Sohn is a media censor, polarizing and destructive, who wants to silence conservative voices. It might seem curious, then, that right-wing outlets like OAN and Newsmax are supporting her nomination. The Journal acknowledged this in one of its editorials and tried to wave it away as pure self-interest, arguing again that Sohn wants less political diversity on the airwaves. It's just a tough argument to make when the very outlets she supposedly wants to see suppressed are backing her. The reason OAN and Newsmax back Sohn and the Journal and its owner, Rupert Murdoch, oppose her is because this isn't so much a right versus left battle as big versus small. Sohn has worked for decades in communications policy advocating for an open and accessible internet. She was a top aide at the FCC during the Obama administration, helping implement net neutrality rules that were later repealed under Trump. Net neutrality, listeners know, ensures that broadband providers have to provide equal data speeds to all companies and not offer fast lanes for big corporations that can pay more for them while throttling others. This unequal access would give unfair advantages to big corporations and stifle competition from smaller outfits. Maybe even more concerning for TV network OAN and Newsmax, which also has a TV channel, is media conglomerate control over the airwaves. Sohn spoke out against Sinclair Broadcast Group's attempted merger with Tribune Media Company, which would have dramatically consolidated the local broadcast TV market, and that merger had to be stopped in the face of mounting public opposition. Actually, according to the group Free Press, the Journal isn't the only media company working to block Sohn. Comcast recently hired lobbyists with close ties to Arizona and West Virginia to work on telecom policy. Arizona Senator Kristen Sinema and West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin are seen as key swing votes on Sohn's appointment. The FCC needs to fill its fifth seat to do its critical work regulating media infrastructure. Gigi Sohn is clearly qualified. So now's a great time to tell your senator to confirm her immediately when they return from recess. Media monitor Andrew Tindall, who's been tracking broadcast nightly news since 1988, found that ABC, CBS, and NBC devoted 562 minutes to the first full month of the war in Ukraine. That's more than the first month of the U.S. invasion of Panama, the U.S. intervention in Somalia, and even the first month of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. As cited by Jim Loeb in Responsible Statecraft, Tindall found that even the two peak months of coverage of the Iraq War each saw less saturated coverage than last month in Ukraine, a fact he found astonishing. We can only conclude that war is much more newsworthy when you're not the one waging it. As the GOP pushes and passes broad laws to prohibit books, discussions, or mental health services on issues of gender identity or sexual orientation under the absurd guise of preventing sexual abuse, the Washington Post is laying out a welcome mat for the party's anti-LGBTQ plus agenda. Under the headline, "Teachers who mention sexuality are grooming kids," conservatives say, Washington Post writers Hannah Nathanson and Mariah Belingit spent the first 12 paragraphs of their April 5th article describing and quoting right-wing claims that teachers talking about gender identity or sexual orientation and those who support them, quote, want children primed for sexual abuse, close quote. As Julie Holler writes for FAIR.org, these malicious accusations are part of a spreading movement led by Florida's Don't Say Gay law, and of course they have not a shred of truth to them. But they will certainly stifle free speech in classrooms and further endanger LGBTQ plus students at a time when many are struggling even more than usual because of the pandemic. It barely matters that the Post brought in some experts later to offer the other side, that actually talking about these things in fact helps curtail sexual abuse, which in schools primarily happens at the hands of heterosexual male teachers, noted all the way down in the 37th paragraph of the article, and they help curtail bullying against LGBTQ kids. In giving the GOP the headline and the extraordinarily lengthy lead, the reporters gave a bigoted and dangerous campaign the right to frame the story as a debate with two somehow comparable sides. Finally, in the wake of a devastating new report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, we learned by way of a tweet from climate scientist Peter Kalmus of a little squib on the front page of the April 10th Los Angeles Times. It reads, quote, "Earth on track to be unlivable. Global warming will surpass tipping point unless greenhouse gas emissions fall fast," a report says, close quote, and directs any interested readers to turn to page 3. Earth to become unlivable, story on page 3. If they need something for the time capsule to explain corporate media response to climate disruption, that will do nicely. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Anywhere in this country, you can turn on the local TV news and see pretty much the same thing. Two hosts, likely a man and a woman, joshing back and forth in between tightly edited clips. A weather person in front of a green screen, some sports, and crime. Lots of crime. Shootings and stabbings and muggings, police taped streets, people marched off in handcuffs, often followed by a call for viewers to phone tips into a Crime Stopper hotline. You're watching Eyewitness News, or some variant on the format pioneered in Philadelphia in the 1960s. Along with its competitor-slash-corollary Action News, this format didn't just revolutionize local TV news, attracting viewers and the ad money that comes with them. It directed viewers' gaze in particular ways, presenting Black Philadelphians through a lens of pathology, their communities as sources of danger and threat. The Philadelphia Inquirer is engaged in a project looking at the roots of systemic racism in America through institutions founded in Philadelphia. Lights, Camera, Crime is an early installment, a look at a widely influential news format and its impacts, reported by our guest, Layla A. Jones. She joins us now by phone from Philadelphia. Welcome to Counterspin, Layla Jones.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, it's strange to think of the Eyewitness News format starting, you know, for many people, it's the only sort of local TV news they've ever known is this kind of crime, crime, crime. Here's a penguin at the zoo, you know. What did you learn about the origin story of this way of doing local TV news?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. That was a feeling that I had while reporting that, you know, this is the kind of news that you think just existed, but no, it was created and intentionally. And also, can I say that that intro really wrapped up the whole piece? I don't see what else I didn't talk to the ad. But yes, what I learned reporting this out, I spoke with the creator of Eyewitness News. It started in 1965. And basically, he was a young guy at the time, 30 years old, and prior to Eyewitness News, what news looked like was one middle-aged to older white male reading through the news in like a radio format, a radio newsreader format. And what the creator of Eyewitness News, Al Primo, learned was that you could have multiple reporters appear on screen with their original reported stories for no additional cost to the station. And when he learned that, he just made it a lot more dynamic. He made a family of reporters, a family of anchors, the male and female that he talked about. They kind of banter back and forth. And what we called it in the piece was kind of the rise of infotainment. It was a mix of showbiz and news, and it was on purpose to draw eyes, to get more advertising and more revenue for the stations. Prior to that, news was not profitable, and afterward, news became network's big moneymaker.
And the format worked so well that, as listeners know, it really spread around the country. Well, I guess let's talk about the context in which this is happening in Philadelphia, because as this infotainment kind of format is growing up and flourishing, this is a time of white flight and changes, demographic, racial changes in Philadelphia, and that backdrop or that context is important.
Yes, exactly. And like you mentioned, it did spread Eyewitness News and then Action News, which came afterwards. It went to more than 200 U.S. cities. It also went international, that format. But, yeah, when it was coming up in the late 60s and Action News in the early 70s, at the same time, there was this suburbanization and white flight happening in urban centers. And for a variety of reasons, if we were coming off of the civil rights movement, there was a change in industry and work in cities. But also, the news was broadcasting city and urban life as something scary, as something very black, as something dangerous. And I guess what we kind of talk about in the piece is that this portrayal of urban environment definitely did fuel fear among viewers. They basically said, we proved in a lab that the more people watched local television news, the more likely they were to associate criminality being black, the more likely they were to support criminal justice policies that fuel mass incarceration, like longer sentences and even the death penalty. And so the way that TV news portrayed black and urban communities really did affect and does affect people's public opinions of black people and of our communities.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what that format was. One of reporter that you spoke to, and one of the great things about the piece is that you really do talk to a lot of veteran journalists, you know, who were there. A guy, Vernon Odom, describes the format as, quote, you'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll watch him die, close quote. So it's no secret internally that they're doing a particular kind of coverage. And in fact, they were told, they had a, you know, consultants tell them, no, crime is your thing. You want to go with crime. And then the question is, what crime? Crimes committed by whom or in which community? They're making decisions. It's not an accident the way this news looks and the effects that it has.
Yeah, you are exactly right. And I think the important point to make is that what was happening when these formats were on the rise is really multi-layered. So first of all, it was being run at the top, and even from the top basically all the way down, by all white people. A lot of these people were very young because 1965, 1970, this was brand new. So they're all learning together. Then they're intentionally trying to attract, and this is especially Action News, intentionally trying to attract a suburban audience. And locally, our suburbs are more white. So they're trying to attract a white suburban audience because they believe that's where the money is. And that's what's going to draw advertisers. We also looked at the commercials. A lot of the commercials in between these news segments featured white families and white picket fences and things that you don't really see in the cities that they're reporting about. So with all those layers going on, what Action News found to work for them and what shot them up past their competitor, Eyewitness News, was focusing happy, upbeat, and community-oriented stories in the suburbs. So the stories about backyard festivals or charity events, they'll have a photographer go out there just to cover those good events, to make those people feel seen and to make sure they tune in and watch the news. At the same time, the stories that can fill up the time and the newscast and are easy, quick, close by, and cheap to cover, which is literally what a veteran anchor Larry Kane told me, are crime stories. He was like, you know, the photographer would just shoot the blood, you shoot the scene, you shoot the victim, whatever they have to say, and you can do it in 20 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And speed was another element of this format. And so it created this dichotomy. And again, I like to say that I don't believe from talking to anyone that it was like, we hate black people and we just want to make them look bad. I just think it was a complete carelessness. And then once they were told, because the stations had been told, this is harmful, they never changed their approach. And I think that's really important, too.
Well, and the piece has that complexity within it, in part because it just allows people to speak, and people are complex. You know, this is, of course, a long unfolding conversation and struggle. And it goes back to, you know, media depictions of black people and brown people and the impacts that has societally. That goes back to the founding, you know, and I always recommend here the book News for All the People by Joe Torres and Juan Gonzalez on that, which is excellent. And then some of our listeners are going to remember the Kerner Commission report back in the wake of 1967 unrest that talked about the problems that we're just talking about, saying that the news is pathologizing black communities and it makes it seem as though only white people have full lives, you know, and go to PTA meetings. Black reporters have been trying to navigate this from the beginning, haven't they? And I just found their experiences and their different strategies very interesting, and I was happy to see those voices in the piece.
Yeah, it's funny because even before, like, reporters were really a thing, black people have been correcting, like, media narratives. So one of the examples, and it happened in Philadelphia that I mentioned, was in 1793 after the yellow fever epidemic, black leaders had to put out their version of news to correct a racist account of their work during that epidemic, their health and safety work. And so what some of the pioneering African-American reporters that I spoke with were Tree Haynes, who is now 95, and in 1965, she was the first black woman news reporter in Philadelphia when she was hired at Eyewitness News, and which was something intentional that the creator, Al Primo, wanted to do. He said he learned that people wanted to see black people and brown people on the news.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that she went out and she tried to do whatever it was that our brown story was. That's what she said. She said she always tried to look for the color. She did what she thought the story should do. And in the editing, she went back with the editors and demanded that they use certain images to run with her story. And usually, you know, she was talking about images of black people, you know, being positive, productive, normal, like we are. Vernon Odom said something really similar, that even when he covered hard news like crime, like violence, like disaster, that he tried to put in the social context that he understood as a black person and that his white colleagues did not understand, is what he said. But, you know, so they always have worked really hard. And, you know, I think a lot of black people have a desire to represent our communities correctly. But one thing I did was ask Ms. Trudy Haynes if she felt like her work there caused institutional change at the station. And what she said was, I don't know if they felt the same way I did.
Mm-hmm.
But she said, I just, you know, tried my best and I stayed on as long as I could.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's always a question and an active question. Do you work inside institutions that need change? Do you go build a whole nother ship over there? And I think we always kind of land on doing both and hopefully supporting one another. And it's very important to, people aren't calling for just more upbeat stories about black people in the news. You know, it's presenting a more full human picture of black communities also involves unpacking the quote-unquote negative stories and actually being able to talk about racism and white supremacy and institutions. And just to go back for 1 second to that format, one of the things about the format is that it doesn't do follow-up. You see the crime, you see the violence, but it isn't the practice of an eyewitness news station to go back to that community, to go back to that family later. And it's that depth and complexity that's part of what people are demanding, yeah, are calling for.
Exactly. One of the experts I talked to, basically, he called it extractive. Like, they just drop in, you know, we've heard of parachute journalism, get their story and go. And that's just because, you know, that's what it's designed to do. It wants to be quick, it wants to be fast, and it wants to get eyeballs on the newscast. It really isn't necessarily about telling the best story. The anchors and reporters from the past and present told me that they kind of feel like print journalists get to tell, you know, a more holistic story, and they just want to be quick.
Right. Yeah.
And so that's how we kind of get where we are now.
Mm-hmm. And cheap as well. Well,
yes.
This interrogation of institutions and practices, and I know anyone listening knows that we're not talking about, this isn't history. We're talking about history because of the way that it relates to the present. It's part of a bigger project that has deeper intentions than most. I'd like to ask you to tell us a little bit about the Inquirer's project, A More Perfect Union, that this piece is part of, because listeners will know that, you know, after George Floyd, there was a moment where we kept hearing that there was going to be a reckoning. We get a reckoning every, you know, year or so. We hear that we're reckoning with racism in this country. But media outlets seem to take it more seriously than they generally do, to see themselves as also institutions that need to be looking internally and looking at their role. And that's what this A More Perfect Union project is about, isn't it?
Yeah, so A More Perfect Union at the Philadelphia Inquirer, it was created by Erin Haynes.
Mm-hmm.
She is our contributing editor, and she also is like the founder at the 19th. But basically, the overarching view of this project is that Philadelphia was the home to a lot of first institutions, the first hospital, the first prison, the first bank, and things like that. So if we talk about institutional racism, we're looking kind of in a lot of places to Philadelphia to figure out how those institutions were founded and how from their beginning racism was baked in. Then we're going forward through the present to see how it's still affecting people, tracing it through that origin point till today, and then kind of trying to look to the future and see, are these institutions making changes? Why or why not? Where can they make changes? And how can we create a more perfect union with the belief that America, like, can work for everyone.
Yeah. Well, finally, nobody you spoke with thinks the work is done or has a kind of, you know, rose-colored glasses view towards it. We will see how truly radical media are going to allow this institutional interrogation work to be. But if we don't fight for it, then what are we doing? And there's a lot we can learn along the way.
Yeah, and I will say that the first chapter, the Inquirer did a look at its own self. I think it was found in, like, 1829, and we got a freelancer to dig into, like, the racial hiring discrimination here. And so it is something that I think media organizations, especially because they're so public-facing, are trying to really take a look at.
Yeah, that was Wesley Lowery, and I would love to end. He quotes Reverend Mark Tyler, who says, "I don't know if the Inquirer is capable of the change that is needed, just like I don't know that America is capable of the change that is needed, but I desperately hope that it is."
Hmm.
Sounds about right. Any final thoughts?
One thing that I wanted to say kind of about the importance of this series and these media stories is that kind of bringing it into right now in the Ukraine with the war going on, they had African-American human rights aides going over to help, and they put out a press release saying that they might face racism from the Ukrainians. And the reason that they said that Black people might especially be victim to that kind of harm and treatment is because of how they're portrayed in the media and because Ukrainians don't usually see African Americans. And that's kind of the whole problem with the TV news, that is portraying Black people to people who don't even live around them, don't live around us. And so it just shows kind of how important those false and non-objective narratives are in shaping public opinion.
All right. Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Layla A. Jones, reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. You can find Lights, Camera, Crime, How a Philly-Born Brand of TV News Harmed Black America, and accompanying video, along with other pieces from the A More Perfect Union project, online at Inquirer.com. Layla Jones, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The website's also the place to learn about our newsletter. It's called Extra, and it's also the place to show support for FAIR if you're so inclined. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listeners, at the top of the hour today, we'll have John Grant on. Don't miss it. It's always good. Wow. Say that right now.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Russian military says it's launched hundreds of strikes across Ukraine in the past 24 hours. Russia claims it's destroyed 16 Ukrainian military facilities in overnight strikes. In western Ukraine, at least 7 people died earlier today after Russian missile strikes hit the city of Lviv. One blast shattered windows of hotel housing evacuees from other parts of Ukraine who'd fled to Lviv for safety. On Sunday, 5 people died in a rocket attack in central Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city. The strikes come as Russia is escalating its offensive in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine. Russian troops have entered the town of Kramina after weeks of bombardment. In the besieged city of Mariupol, Ukrainian soldiers rejected a Russian ultimatum Sunday to surrender their arms or be eliminated. Russia seized most of the strategically located port city, but some Ukrainian fighters have refused to lay down their arms. During an interview with CNN, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, said no one knows how many people have died in Mariupol.
No one knows how many people died among the civilian population. If anyone gives you a figure, it would be a total lie. Hundreds of thousands were evacuated. Several thousand, tens of thousands were forced to evacuate in the direction of the Russian Federation. And we do not know where they are. They've left no document trail. And among them are several thousands of children. We want to know what happened to them, whether they are in good health. Unfortunately, there just isn't any information on this.
On Sunday, Austria's Chancellor Karl Nehammer said Russian President Vladimir Putin believes he is winning the war. The Austrian Chancellor met with Putin in Moscow last week. During the meeting, Putin defended his invasion of Ukraine, saying it's necessary for Russia's security. On Sunday, Pope Francis called for peace in Ukraine. He said the world is marking an Easter of war.
Peace upon tormented Ukraine, sorely tried by the violence and destruction of the cruel and senseless war into which it was dragged. On this terrible night of suffering and death, may a new dawn of hope soon arise. Let there be a decision for peace. May there be an end to the flexing of muscles while people are suffering.
Per favore. Per favore.
Please, please, let us not get used to war. Let us commit ourselves to imploring peace from our balconies and in our streets. May the leaders of nations hear people's plea for peace.
During his Easter address, the Pope also warned about nuclear war and called for peace in Jerusalem. The Pope's remarks came as Israeli forces raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque and occupied East Jerusalem for the second time in 3 days, clearing worshippers from the third holiest site in Islam. 19 Palestinians were injured Sunday, some of them hit by rubber-coated steel bullets. Over 150 Palestinians were arrested in another raid on the mosque Friday. To protest Israel's violent crackdown, the United Arab List political party has suspended its participation in Israel's coalition government led by Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, who's already lost his majority last week. We'll go to Jerusalem after headlines to speak with a Palestinian activist and an Israeli researcher. U.S. and South Korean officials are expressing concern that North Korea may soon resume nuclear weapons testing. On Saturday, the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un personally oversaw a test of a new type of guided weapon that could be used to deliver a tactical nuclear warhead. Meanwhile, the United States and South Korea are beginning 9 days of joint military drills. North Korea has condemned the drills, saying they're a rehearsal for war. In South Korea, 9 people were injured early Sunday as gunshots rang out at a nightclub in the town of Furman. It was the second mass shooting in South Carolina over the weekend following a Saturday shootout at a shopping mall in Columbia that left 14 people injured. Meanwhile, police in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania are searching for suspects who opened fire on a party at an Airbnb property early Sunday, killing 2 17-year-olds and injuring at least a dozen other people. Pittsburgh officials said as many as 200 people were attending the party, many of them underage, when multiple assailants fired at least 90 rounds from handguns and at least one rifle. Among the injured were people who leapt from high windows to escape the violence. In South Africa, the death toll from last week's devastating floods has risen to 443. Dozens of people are still missing in the KwaZulu-Natal province, where heavy rains triggered massive flooding and mudslides. Tens of thousands of people have been left homeless. Scores of hospitals and more than 500 schools have been destroyed in what's being described as one of South Africa's worst natural disasters. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has directly linked the floods to the climate emergency. Devastated areas included in Lazi, a township near Durban.
What makes me angry is that this situation is always happening. It keeps destroying our possessions that we work hard for all the time. There are no jobs as it is, but our possessions keep getting destroyed by continuous floods that should be addressed by authorities. So you end up hopeless because no one comes back to give you a report on plans to resolve such situations, and the floods keep coming back to destroy us.
The Biden administration said Friday it'll resume selling leases for oil and gas drilling on public lands. As part of its plan, the Interior Department will increase the royalty rate for new leases by about 50%. Climate action groups say the move is dangerously out of step with U.S. commitments to curb emissions under the Paris Climate Accord. The Sunrise Movement responded in a statement, quote, "The fact of the matter is that more drilling will not solve high gas prices right now. So why is Biden breaking his campaign promise to stop drilling on public lands?" Unquote. Activists with Extinction Rebellion held civil disobedience actions in cities around the world over the weekend to demand governments follow through on pledges to curb emissions and stop using fossil fuels. Here in New York, over a dozen people were arrested Saturday as they blocked a busy Manhattan intersection near the historic Flatiron Building. In France, Extinction Rebellion activists forced the closure of a main central square in Paris Saturday, chaining themselves together by their necks using bicycle locks. The protesters say neither of the remaining candidates in France's runoff presidential election will help prevent climate catastrophe.
Of course, we're rising up against the far right, whose values are violent and are unacceptable for us, and against a candidate who for 5 years cast the ecology issue aside and lied. The incumbent president, Emmanuel Macron, promised us to act for the climate. He claimed to be the champion of the climate. He put in place a citizens' climate convention so that citizens could give suggestions that will allow for greenhouse gas reductions by 40% by 2030, and in the end, nothing was done.
Salvage crews in the Mediterranean are racing to prevent an environmental disaster after a tanker carrying as much as 1,000 tons of diesel fuel sank off Tunisia's southeastern coast Saturday. It's Tunisia's largest maritime oil disaster since 2018, when a collision between a Tunisian tanker and a Cyprus-flagged ship spilled hundreds of tons of fuel into the sea. In China, nearly 400 million are now living under a full or partial lockdown as China attempts to stop the spread of COVID-19. In Shanghai, local authorities have reported the deaths of 3 people with COVID, the first since the city was locked down in March. In other pandemic news, Philadelphia's reinstated indoor mask mandate goes into effect today. Over a dozen local businesses and residents have sued Philadelphia over the mask mandate, or sued the state of Pennsylvania. Tension is escalating along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. On Saturday, Pakistani airstrikes inside Afghanistan killed at least 45 people. This came 2 days after Pakistan said militants based in Afghanistan killed 7 Pakistani soldiers in North Waziristan. Pakistan has accused the Taliban-led government in Afghanistan of allowing armed militants to use the country as a base to carry out attacks against Pakistan. The Wall Street Journal is reporting the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, personally helped force Yemeni President Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi to resign earlier this month, handing over power to a new presidential council. One Saudi official told the Journal the former Yemeni president is now effectively under house arrest in Riyadh and his communications have been restricted. Houthi rebels have refused to recognize the new presidential council. Over the past 6 years, the UN estimates the U.S.-backed Saudi war in Yemen has killed nearly 400,000 people, many from hunger. At least 35 migrants are presumed dead after a small wooden boat capsized off the coast of Libya. According to the International Organization for Migration, at least 476 migrants have died attempting to reach Europe across the central Mediterranean since January. The IOM said, quote, "The continued loss of life in the Mediterranean must not be normalized. Human lives are the cost of inaction," they said. Here in the United States, authorities arrested about 210,000 migrants trying to cross the U.S.-Mexican border during the month of March. That's the highest monthly arrest total in 20 years. Roughly half the migrants were expelled under the Trump-era Title 42 pandemic rule, which blocks people from seeking asylum at the border. President Biden's vowed to lift Title 42 next month, but the decision has prompted an outcry from Republican and some Democratic lawmakers. Meanwhile, the Department of Homeland Security has granted temporary protected status to Cameroonians living in the United States for the first time. We'll have more on this story later in the program. The world's richest man, Elon Musk, is facing a new obstacle in his bid to buy Twitter. On Friday, Twitter's board of directors adopted what's known as a poison pill to thwart Musk's $43 billion hostile takeover. The move could allow existing Twitter shareholders to buy additional shares at a discounted price. This would dilute Musk's stake in Twitter and make it more expensive for him to buy the company. And the pioneering Mexican human rights activist Rosaria Ibarra has died at the age of 95. After her son was forcibly disappeared in 1975, she founded the Eureka Committee of the Disappeared. Ibarra would later become the first woman to run for president of Mexico. Mexico's National Human Rights Commission described her as a, quote, pioneer in the defense of human rights, peace, and democracy in Mexico. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And now, a few minutes of swing music. Barnett, that's also called Skyliner. Now we'll be followed by Count Basie and some Duke Ellington as we lead up to the top of the hour and join John Grant.
Thank you.
Coming up, John Grant. Let's see if we can get him on the horn. We've got it. John Grant, the only man in Kansas that reads the New York Times. We have John Grant on the horn. It's another great day in Kansas. 55 degrees. Go, John. 55 degrees here. And that's it. Then we go back.
It's about low 50s here. Yeah, yeah.
It's supposed to another series of gifts to the great southeast at Alabama and Georgia is coming through here tomorrow for the next 2 days. Anticipating some major thunderstorms. Yeah, tornadoes, thunderstorms. We've been pretty lucky, really, I mean, here in Kansas.
Well, you've been, typically, I noticed last week you were in the red zone when the tornadoes were very likely out there. So I don't know, I guess you didn't get it. But you were in the tornado
one,
zone.
One came through. It inspired me. I'm going to. I might as well tell the listening audience that soon, through the courtesy of Weather Underground, not the political group, the weather network.
Right. Gotcha.
I'm going to be a tornado came so close. It was a small tornado. It was like a F1. It came about 4 miles from our house and went.
Oh, really?
Going from south. Yeah, it was that close. For the first time in 20 years, people, everybody went to the basement. So, so I'm going to be part of the Weather Underground Network. I've purchased my son. Actually, he has purchased a weather station that is on the Wi-Fi. You can put it out and it runs all the time, tells you the wind. It's a weather station, and it's going to be hooked up to Weather Underground, and you'll be able to literally type in the zip code or 10 acres, Kansas. That's what it's called. The weather station will be called, and you literally, John, your Pennsylvania listeners, they can watch the tornado on live radar hit our place next time. So you have to
give me a call so I can watch your house be blown away. Yeah.
Oh, no, you just go to the Weather Underground website and type in 10 acres Kansas.
Well, yeah, but I don't know if there's a tornado looming,
Well, you might want to look at you. See, it tells you any zip code in the United States. It tells you.
Okay.
And because I'm one of the weather stations, there's only three in Kansas, or no, in Jefferson County. There's like 100,000 weather stations hooked up to this internet. It's pretty neat. Yeah. I think my son dreamed it up, and I'm so proud
cool,
of him to hook us up with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. He didn't like being in the basement.
Right. Exactly.
He had to go to the. He and everybody went to the basement for about a half hour to 45 minutes. And if the power, fortunately, we didn't lose any electrical power. But normally that happens. We usually lose electricity before the bad weather hits, So we didn't lose it this time. But he didn't like it. He did not like being in the basement. He wanted to be on the internet. He didn't care about all that, So he's going to hook up this weather station, put it out in the yard. Oh, well, actually out in the pasture. So we're going to have a weather station in the pasture. Hooked up to the world internet.
You're really
on. How's it going with you?
Well, we're good
you got
here.
Your New York Times?
I got my New York Times, and Yeah, I'm looking at an article here, an op-ed by Elizabeth Warren, who's saying there how the Democrats can avoid disaster in November.
Oh, God. Good luck.
You know, I guess actually cutting the crap and being straight up and down with things. I don't know. It's like she says, I mean, she wants Democrats to focus on Democratic things, you know, which is, of course, what they should be doing. But it's hard to say what her her point is here.
I mean, I like her ideas generally. I like her. I like Warren's ideas generally. I mean, she's good at she's sort of good at let's tax the extremely wealthy, blah blah blah. Work on reforming the tax
code.
Right.
She wants educational. Yeah, she wants the standard liberal thing. She's she's right on, and you know she wants to push this Biden agenda. You know, and use the 50%. The 50 votes they have in Senate now to start doing things. They need to get it done, but they're afraid of losing that 50% 50 Senate majority in November. We'll see.
There's definitely a big chance that the House of Representatives is going to be taken over by the crazy.
Well, it's a possibility of both of them. Yeah, right, yeah.
I mean, it's really a tragedy. I don't throw my hands in the air. I just, I'm going to tell everybody all the way through summer to, the only answer is to get out and vote. That you don't miss it.
Well,
that's what I tell people,
especially my friends on the far anti-war left. You know, it's like, cut the crap, just get out and get everybody out to vote, and hold your nose if you have to.
The change won't come fast enough, but it can, if they could stop this so-called midterm swing, it would be a big changer. In the aftermath of Donnie Trump, you would think that a large majority of the country's voting population would get out again and make sure that this guy doesn't and his supporters doesn't come back.
One would think. We look to gain a Senate seat here from the Republicans in Pennsylvania, of course. We have a good shot at it. We have John Fetterman running, the big ox, he's running.
I like him.
Yeah, I like him too. I'm going to vote
Shrek.
For him.
He's Shrek. I affectionately call him Shrek.
Yeah, that's good. I like that Shrek. That's good. I sometimes call him Frankenstein, coming in the door. There he comes. But he's parlayed his bizarreness into something serious, and he's running against Connor Lamb, who's this very handsome young ex-Marine. He wasn't in Iraq or anything, but he was a Marine, and he's been taking out these nasty ads against Fetterman, calling Fetterman a democratic socialist and all this kind of stuff.
That may blow up in his face, not Fetterman.
Well, let's hope it does. We're hoping it does, and exactly. It's like, so what if he's a democratic socialist? At least he's not a democratic fascist, It's like, Christ.
Right. Or corporate.
You're right. Exactly.
I want to give you something, and the
all right.
I just noticed there's a guy that came around before that blew it, young guy, is about ready and may very well take Texas as the governor, knocked down Abbott of the governor of Texas.
Yeah, Beto O'Rourke, right. Yeah.
Beto O'Rourke. I mean, this he's really – he came up – you know, this – I mean, these conservatives, these neo-conservatives, these new conservatives are really sort of thick-headed idiots. Because,
yeah.
I mean, Abbott, you know what he did? He closed the border – to,
well, he did
traffic.
That silly thing
and,
with the trucks. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah. What a dumbass.
Yeah, and then, and of course, he's also got that thing, remember last winter where they, you know, the, all the heating was out, they lost heat, and everybody's having
He's got real blood on his hands.
Yeah, so he has, he's tripped over his member a number of times there, yeah. But, Beto O'Rourke, I think Beto O'Rourke is a really attractive candidate. My God, he looks like, you know, a character out of the movies and Jimmy Stewart, you know, he's this tall, lanky Westerner, you know, and he's smart, he pays attention, he's always smiling, he's a happy warrior, you know, and, he pays attention, and he's a sense of Texas community with all sorts of Mexicans and everybody, you know. Beto, of course, is I think he is, short for Roberto or something. He has a even a name that's – his first name is basically Spanish, I think. Beto, you know. So very interesting character. And – it would be, you know, the Texas governorship is notoriously what they call a weak governor. You know, George W. Bush, of course, was a weak governor. And so they're like, they make a lot of noise and they make a lot of, you know, public relations presence and things like that. But the real power is in the Texas legislature, from what I understand. And, of course, they are, you know, terrible. You know, it still makes a difference, though, who's the governor of Texas.
Yeah. Well, there is some blue sky out there. I gotta let people know. Here in Kansas, the same way, similar to Texas, we have a dominated, except I think our state lawmakers are in some respects crazier than even Texas. But the governor
you're probably
is Democrat, Laura Kelly.
Crazier than our legislatures who are actually certifiable, so that's pretty bad, yeah.
Well, you got to remember, listeners, Rudy Giuliani held his big thing at the Four Seasons in Pennsylvania, his big hair dripping, you know, his hair dripping.
He actually boosted the business of the Four Seasons lawn gardeners treat, you know, the lawn service, the Four Seasons lawn service. He, you know, their business was a killer after that, you know, so they couldn't do enough lawns, you know. It's, my God. Thanks, Rudy, baby.
In that Philadelphia heat, the hair was dripping brown down his face.
Oh God!
I mean,
God help us! Yeah, and then of course he appears in this stupid movie of zipping up his pants with some would-be prostitute. You know, it's like what was that guy that always poses as a fraud? But
what is it?
But you know, you should see if you don't have HBO, I guess. But HBO last Friday. Bill Maher had a stand-up routine he did in Miami. Oh, it was dynamite. It was really dynamite. And he had this whole shtick in which he referred to Rudy Giuliani as a vampire. You know, it was very funny. I couldn't reproduce it, but it was like, you know, there was just, you know, it's hard to imagine somebody more sort of foolish on a major level than Rudy Giuliani. You know, I mean, he was the nation's mayor and all this horseshit during 9/11.
Oh God, yeah.
And now he is a cynical joke. I mean, he And he should be going to prison, for God's sake. But, you know, for some reason they keep, you know, avoiding indicting the piece of shit. But anyway.
I can't. I mean,
that's
I can't
our boy Rudy.
Do you think it's lack of money? I mean, why would he take all these crazy publicity chances and then fail so miserably? He's got to be desperate.
You know, it really makes me wonder too. And I think what it is with Rudy is, I think his character is that dark and that low. You know that. He is a real bad agent, a bad operator, and he links with Donald Trump, and the two of them are like, you know, 1 + 1 = 11, you know, and they're really a bad fit. And so I think Rudy just, you know, goes along thinking that, you know, their power will win in the end, whereas It hasn't worked out for him that way, that his, you know, this power that he feels he has doesn't really exist, you know, over time, and he's certainly lost it. And he's, you know, I think he's a really bad actor, you know, morally. I remember seeing his son, I mean, when his son was about 12, and it was at a Yankees game, and for some reason they were showing Rudy with somebody. Well, his son was up front harassing people, just being an obnoxious little prick. You know,
really? No kidding.
Yeah, his son. It was embarrassing, and it reminded me of this when I was in El Salvador. I was at a market, and I watched this woman in this, you know, who was a upper class woman, I guess, very superior, and she had this kid with her that was just going around and harassing all the peasants and things in the market, and I followed him. I just couldn't believe how arrogant this little prick was. And Rudy's son reminded me of that Salvadoran kid, I tell you. I mean, and in fact, his son has made an appearance over the last several years. And it's become a joke, and ostracized from various groups, I guess, because he's so, you know, pathetically silly and outrageous in a you know, arrogant,
like,
Giuliani kind of way. So it seems to run in the family, some kind of, you know, super-duper arrogance that in Rudy's case has not panned out for him. I think he's... you know, I think it is possible they will indict him. Indicted by his own, you know, office that he used to hold. You know,
yeah.
You know, federal attorney in New York. So,
well, I mean, you know, it's just, I think it comes with, it comes to conservatives to, especially this last generation of the 1980s, the Reagan conservatives. Once they get their money, look at Clarence Thomas, the Supreme Court, you know,
yeah,
on the Supreme Court, and his wife goes around. You were talking about
Rudy's
son. Think were married to Jenny Thomas. Oh my God!
I know.
Think of that.
It's incredible, isn't it? I mean,
she runs around.
She
taps millionaires to finance the buses to go to take over to riot at the Capitol. I mean, in January.
I know. Yeah.
I mean, who knows?
And of course, that one ruling that ruled on, you know, some outrageous thing where Trump wanted documents, you know, presented from court. It was like 8-1. Everybody said, yeah, the document should be turned off. It's nonsense. And who was it? It was Clarence Thomas was the one justice who said, no, those papers or whatever documents should not be turned over. And it turns out that his wife is in those documents, apparently. You know, his wife's emails or Twitter accounts or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah, and
yeah.
So,
yeah,
I mean... But the point is, there is no ethics, and this is the bizarre, really funny part of it. There is absolutely no ethical overarching restrictions for the Supreme Court. You are on there for life. You cannot be fired for any reason. And, you know, there's no ethics. You can get away with murder.
Well, that's a learning thing for the public, I think, the general public.
Yeah, well, I think
myself.
It is. And, you know, all other federal judges have, you know, ethical restrictions. You can't X, Y, Z. You know, you could not, you know, it's illegal to rule on something that your wife is involved in. But not
well,
on the Supreme
yeah,
Court
I mean,
of the United States of America. No, it's not. You know,
well,
can,
he went to the hospital. I mean, this is sort of like Donald Trump saying he didn't want he wanted anesthesia for his colonoscopy. I don't know when they stuff the hose up your ass.
Yeah, the garden.
He didn't want Pence to. He didn't want Mike Pence. Remember when he went to Walter Reed? Donnie went to Walter Reed.
Oh yeah,
Reed.
So he wanted it without anesthesia.
That was the inside joke, from what I hear, inside the White House. Is that?
Well, yeah, I've had that a couple
didn't
times. I don't think I think I'm glad they put me out. You know, it's like.
Yeah, I've got mine coming.
I'm sticking a hose up my ass.
Please.
You know,
I've got a high tolerance.
I remember the first guy that
myself,
did it. He said, "Would you like a photograph?" I said, "Wait a minute,
God."
You want to send me a photograph of my large intestine from the inside? Why would
probably
I possibly want that, you know? And, I mean, really. And so he said, no, so I told him, but I am a photographer, so why don't you show me your camera? And he did. He took it out. It was like a camera on the head of a snake, you know. It was like... Oh, okay, and there it is.
Oh, my God, yeah,
all right. That's a cool camera. I never saw one like that before.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, tell your doctor the next time if he keeps that stuff, have him send it out, put it on the net, and then I could put it on the slideshow. Here's John Grant's large intestine.
You could. This is my portrait here. Yeah, it kind of reminds me of that. Remember that Raquel Welch movie where they shrunk Raquel and a team and some rocket ship and a submarine. They miniaturized them and they sent them into somebody's body.
Oh, Fantastic Voyage.
Yeah, that
was the name of it. Fantastic.
I think Raquel Welch was in a bikini and she was showing off her breasts and everything as she was going through the intestines. You know. avoiding whatever they have to avoid down there.
Yeah. John Grant has a teeny tiny Raquel Welch submarine in his guts.
Then you never know. You know, my little secret.
We can Photoshop that in on that picture. And
oh, good. I'm going to have a real reputation.
I wonder if what she's got to be some grand old lady now. I mean, is she even alive?
Right.
I guess.
Well, I still remember Dr. No, the first Sean Connery, 007 film. I remember reading. I must have been like 16. You know, I remember reading a review in Time magazine where it says Ursula Andress. Comes out of the water in the Bahamas, I think, and it looks like she's wearing her aqualungs on the front. She's well endowed, young lady, of course, actress. You know, this is the introduction of Raquel Welch. Well,
it's
I saw Raquel Welch in Vietnam, too. I mean, I definitely have a Raquel Welch.
Really? No shit.
did. Bob Hope, and he had Raquel Welch with him.
Oh,
she was prancing around in a bikini and, you know, shaking it up for everybody. And, you know, they were the MPs at times had to throw people off the stage who were coming up there to try to touch her, you know, like, get out of there. Like, you
fucking dog.
The Bob Hope Show, and he was up there with his golf club, you know, making jokes about, you know, horny GIs and Raquel and all this stuff.
Oh, my God. It's true.
It was the Bob
Sad.
Hope Show.
Yeah,
in Pleiku.
I got to admit, in 1973, the closest I came to, Ursula Andress or Raquel Welch was at, to hustle up my buddies, you know, and come up with a buck or two gas so we could drive 22 miles to go to a theater just to be able to see some women's breasts. I mean,
there you go,
pathetic.
Right?
So it's
young boys.
This is a pathetic existence. It really was. I mean, I confess to it. I mean, literally finding quarters, you know, and trying to come up with the gas. We've got to go see 007, man. We've got to go see
right.
it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. I got Raquel Welch confused with Ursula Andress there, by the way. And
Ursula,
so,
it doesn't matter. It's just a body, man. It's all it is.
It's like,
I mean, it's a body. I mean, we would laugh. We would go there, and we would pay more attention to the introduction of the 007 movies because of the the silhouettes of the naked women. The naked women
that,
dancing around in silhouettes.
That sound.
I mean, that was...
The rifling and the pistol and all that stuff.
Well,
you know, speaking of going as a young boy, I used to skip school a lot in high school in my senior year because, as I've told you, baby.
This was in Florida.
Yeah,
right?
And I won the contest to sign C.A. Harris's, the dean's signature. And so everybody, the forms I'd fill them in. You know, so we'd get away with absences. We'd go surfing on South Beach up in Miami Beach. And there was, still on Miami Beach, just up from Government Cut on the south end of Miami Beach, there was an old vaudeville theater, right? And in the afternoon, they would have strip shows. I mean, classic, the old style kind of strip shows. And they had these women in their 40s, you know, and big, and, it's nothing like pole dancing. This was the old style. So we would sneak in there, and I guess we paid our money. And I just remember these five kids were sitting there watching all this stuff. And then they had to take the media.
In, huh?
Oh, yeah. I guess they didn't care, right? Yeah. And they had these two comedians, and they were like clowns. And they would come in between the ladies who stripped. And I say ladies, I mean some of them were like approaching retirement, you know. It's like, and these guys would. I remember they were always reaching into their pants and making jokes about their pants and stuff, and you know it was like classic vaudeville. I mean it was the end of something.
Yeah,
you know?
That's what I was just saying.
I mean, and it went on to pole dancing after that. You know, I mean more modern pole dancing.
Yeah, after the 80s.
I mean, where's the art?
It's more creative,
I mean?
Now. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to explain that phenomena change in, in terms of, what do they call them? Gentlemen clubs out here.
Gentlemen's club, yes. Right.
Out here. And they don't have very, very, very few out here in Canton. The Bible Belt, Kansas. I mean, very few, but they exist. Wichita, on the outskirts of Kansas City, Kansas. There's one in Lawrence, outside near the. Now, ideally, Lawrence is a blue oasis in the middle of a vast red state, confusing state. University of Kansas. So there's a lot of so-called free thinkers and liberals there. And I always, I had to serve a subpoena on this guy, and he was, no, it wasn't a subpoena. I had to apprehend this guy because he was, he would jump bond. Yeah, I had jumped. I was bounty hunting at that time. And I,
so
I
you had to strong arm him or put a gun on him or what?
Well, that's always a possibility, but it's all, John, it's all up to the, I mean, it's really how do you want to do it? I mean, hard.
Right,
easy.
Of course. No,
so
I understand.
You make it easy.
Yeah.
And then this guy was, he wasn't a fat cat. He wasn't a really rich guy, but he skipped, and I tracked him down to the one strip bar, well, strip joint, and it was, it was a, dig this, Kansas listeners, dig this. If you want to know where the one strip bar, I mean, all nude, everything, in Lawrence, Kansas is, at least it's still there. It's between North Lawrence, leaving Lawrence, and going to the little itty-bitty airport. They have a little itty-bitty airport outside of Lawrence.
Okay.
And there's a strip of it. And it's tiny. And we're talking it's the size of maybe a like a maybe a 7-Eleven store or something.
So it's like a strip club, and a strip mall.
Yeah. Well, no, actually, it's so
strip mall,
so
strip
bad.
Club.
Oh no, this is so bad. I talked to some of the old guys that were there. I tracked him. I tracked this guy to there. He didn't know I was hunting him. You know, he didn't know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's the way to do it. And you know, you don't dress up. You just dress like it. And I was talking to the guy. They said, "Oh, all the business executives and the sports teams, the football teams, and the basketball teams." They all, the college, the university, they all stop here on the way to get into the planes to go wherever they go to play games.
Yeah, well, of course you got some time to kill. Stop at the strip club. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It makes good sense.
It's a tiny little place. I mean, it was terrible. They wouldn't let me in. They consider it a private club.
Oh,
like
well, there
only,
you go.
You
a gentleman's club, a private club,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. So I went in there in my detective's monkey suit and went in there, you know, and paid $10. And they said, well, you know, fill this form out, who you are, you have show ID, the whole shit.
Special guest.
And they said, we'll mail you a membership card if we approve you. I says, I can't be approved. I've got to get in here, man. I've got
to. Well, what is the criteria for approving you? What? You have to be what?
I know.
You have to be a horny jaybird or what?
it looked like a throwback from the football, the KU football team that was there at the door. It was a big son of a bitch, you know. I mean, so I was about to argue with him. I just said, look, man, I just got to. I said, I'll fill this out. Here's my ID. Here's, you know, $10.
Right.
Let me in. He let me in, and I went in there. And
so
I was
what? Then
that
you went up and down the aisle looking for the guy, or what?
Well, quietly. I didn't go up and down. I mean, you know, that's too thuggish.
So it's dark in there, and you know, and there's somebody performing,
I
guess, right?
Really?
So what is the first thing you said? Like, okay, pal, this is it, or what did you say? I mean.
Be absolutely honest. What I did is I cut the I was cutting the crap with these old guys at the bar, and they were telling me these stories about you'd be surprised who comes in here. You know, like the football team on its way to Florida. You know, we talked
Monsignor Phillips.
Yeah, right. And I'm like, oh, really? No kidding. Go, yeah, that's why it's out here near the airport, you know.
Father
go,
Charles.
Kidding, you know? Right. I asked this guy. So I was visiting him, and I eyeballed the guy. He was, you know, in the room. He was there. And
okay.
So I asked this guy who was educating me about the private gentleman club. He was a paid-up member, I mean, obviously. I said, well, what do you do? And he was the county coroner.
I get tired of looking at dead people all day. I want to look at somebody alive and jumping around.
Right. I mean, what are they called? I can't remember. Hell, I'm married to a doctor. I can't remember. Pathologist? Is that the name of a pathologist?
Well, a pathologist is a doctor who deals in dead people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, an autopsy assistant or an autopsy operator is the one who does the cutting up. I witnessed an autopsy back in the
70s. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I asked him, what do you do? And he says, I'm a pathologist. And he said, do you know what that is? And I said, I think I do. I said, I'm married to a doctor. I think I know what it is. I think I know what it is. And he laughed and bought me a drink. And
I heard my father say this, who taught in a medical school. He said, the thing about the pathologists are, these are guys or women who have terrible bedside manners, and so they end up dealing with dead people.
Right.
They're just
easy.
Bad personalities, easy. And they dead people don't care if they're bad personalities. His bedside manner isn't quite up to dealing with live patients.
Yeah, right. So I'm watching this guy, I'm eyeballing this guy quietly while I'm talking to the county coroner or whatever, a pathologist, a guy that plays the dead, makes his living off of it.
No, wait, let me get this straight. You run into a pathologist in the strip club, and you're trying to find out about this subject that you're investigating, tracking down.
I'm trying to catch him. I'm trying to catch him.
Right,
but
you know he's there, and you're talking to a pathologist who's a regular attendee at the strip club.
Titty joint. That's titty joint. Yeah, everybody's just... And He's buying me drinks, so I'm not in a rush to get this guy. You know what I mean?
Wow. this is during the day.
Oh yeah, middle of the afternoon actually, and it was and I couldn't get enough. I wasn't getting hardly shit paid anything for doing this. It's dangerous work, as hell, man. And, so I waited until this guy, my subject, went to the bathroom. He went to the
right.
There wasn't even a women. There's only a men's room. By the way, there was only.
I guess that makes sense.
It wasn't even unisex. It was just men's room. You know,
right.
That's where you went.
Of course.
I waited until he went in there, and he had his dick in his hands, and I told him. I came up behind him and told him who I was, and and he didn't do anything.
I'm glad for that old
detail. It worked. I said, you've got to come with me. Don't fuck this up for yourself.
Yeah, did you make him wash his hands before he left or what?
No, I said, I've got to do this. And he didn't know if I was a cop or what. And I purposely did that. He didn't know who I was. He thought maybe I was a cop. You know, I had a little kid badge, but I didn't say who I was. I didn't go.
You didn't disavow him of that possibility.
No, I handcuffed him, and I put the cuffs in the front, which is dangerous as hell. But I was trying to be a real gentleman about the whole thing. And escorted him out to my car and took him back to the county jail and booked him in. But, I mean, it was a hairy little – that was my hairy experience in a strip bar, a burlesque. It was – sad about it? It was all these college girls. Is that what you said? You had two old ladies when you were in high school.
Well,
what
year would this have been? You were talking about this incident.
This would have been 19 about Reagan time, 1985, 19.
Well, see, I'm talking about 1964.
Yeah,
and I think 1964 was just at the end of the old traditional classic, what am I calling it? You know, strip clubs of, what's the word I'm thinking
burlesque.
Of? I can't. Burlesque, of course. You know,
burlesque.
You know, Blaze Star and all those old features and things,
yeah.
You know. And this was kind of the end of that era, if you will. Into the newer era of you know, more skanky kind of strip clubs and things like that, I guess. Not that I'm into the various arts of the strip
club.
Yeah,
I know. Yeah, that was the only time I really, in the course of duty, I had to go to one of those places, honestly. That was the only time I've ever had to do that. And that's the last time I really was in it. But they
it was all in the line of your work.
I was amazed. I mean, it was a world I think I've only been to like three of them in my lifetime. You know what I mean? So one guy that was a coconut.
I remember.
He was a cocaine block. What? Go ahead.
I remember one night being in Philly with two of my buddies, and we were at the White Dog Cafe. We'd been drinking there for a while, and we were about to go, and then suddenly Bob Hennell, bless his heart, he's passed away. He had cancer, but Bob had one word. Before we go, we got to go here. And so, where are we going, Bob? Just follow me. And so Bob is this is about 11:30 at night. You know, Bob is stroking it out. I'm going to Frank. Where's he going? What's going on here? What's he want? And so he took us down the steps. This is in West Philadelphia, down the steps into a pole dancing place, you know. I had a pretty sheltered life. I don't hang out in pole dancing places. And Bob was just beside himself. This was the greatest. And, you know, I think he put a $5 bill on somebody's G-string and all that kind of stuff, you know. But, he just... It just cracked me up. He couldn't wait. We're trying to keep. Where's he going? God, where's he going? Anyway, I don't know. How do we get onto this? This is amazing.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't. Somehow we got into the.
You've had a 20-minute riff on strip clubs.
strip clubs and 007 movies.
That's where it started. Right. Ursula Andress. Ursula Andress and her Aqualungs on the front. Yeah, that was it.
Well, I'm sure that's not on the front page of the New York Times, so we sort of already got off the subject. Plus, we're in the middle of a war. We got a fever for war.
Well, I think the news is so absurd that, you know, we ended up in this absurd sort of realm here. But it is an absurd news time because this war is, I think, going, you know, into places that we probably don't want it to go, you know. And, I don't know what you want to call it, World War III or what, but it's pretty, pretty serious. As I'm thinking, all of us have our opinions and this and that. I read the Times or we see it on this or that, or we read the Nation, whatever.
All right.
And we think we know what's going on, but I'm not sure we do. I think it's happening, but
it's happening. This can't be happening. This cannot be happening.
It is happening.
it is.
Yeah, and the sanctions are beginning. Here's a big story in the center. The burden of sanctions on Moscow begins to show. In other words, it's only getting worse as their invasion. You know, they're persisting, and they're going to really clobber the South and the East. So the sanctions are only going to go up, and Putin's saying that if you send more weapons, he's going to threatens to do something. And there was a story yesterday of the expertise and experience that the Russians have in hacking the internet. And that,
uh-huh, yeah.
They've like our township here in White Marsh Township, it's a secret. You know, Luann happened to hear it buzz, buzz, buzz whispering that our township was hacked by these Russians. And what the Russians do is apparently they just fiddle around and they figure out how to get in, but they don't do anything. In other words, they set up their ducks and, you know, wait for the opportune time when they want to really lower the boom. And so they really haven't lowered the boom in any place, from according to this story. And he's threatening. He's always threatening that kind of thing to lower the boom and really muck up our infrastructure and, you know, all kinds of things that might be possible. I find it amazing because, you know, I'm a bit of a Luddite and I, you know, barely use my iPhone. And that I've been cautious of all this. Whereas, you know, the world, not just the country, world has thrown itself in all of this stuff so that we're really vulnerable. And you know, we're really vulnerable and we assume the accoutrements of civilization, all this infrastructure that we take for granted. And, you know, if it started falling away, we would really be a mess in this country. You know, it's just something to be aware of, you know, that, you know, get your life, I'm conscious of it, my pathetic single life of avoiding the internet and the iPhone as much as possible, using it, but not relying on it, you know, that I could do without it just fine. But I don't know. It's pretty scary here.
Well, I think it's—I don't know—scary, but it's you know, for my understanding is that Russia is on the internet. It's sort of like that's the place to go. I'm trying to remember what some hacker told me once that they route their way. Hackers all over the world use Russia as a place to hack from, but they do it remotely. In other words, you can be sitting in Nebraska using the Russian internet system to hack into other, to do all the dirty work that you want to do.
I think what you're saying is what I'm saying is that they, in other words, they're setting up their ducks over the years and decades here, if you will, and they're, you know, their capacity for doing really malicious harm is real. But, of course, they know once they really lower the boom, cyber war is out of the bag, and it's like, a real...
Well, you know, there's all... And there's, and there's also all kinds of wild talk about satellite killing... things, you know, flying in space and blowing up satellites.
Well,
that would be a...
Well, that's why we got a space force now, thanks to Donald Trump, You know...
The all-knowing wisdom of Donnie.
Yeah, I mean, shooting down each other's satellites. You know, we have GPS satellites that, you know, we use without thinking on our silly little iPhones where we, you know, find our way around these days. I just looked up, I mean, talk about Google Earth and all this stuff. I'm about to make a trip to back to where I was raised in South Dade County, Florida. And I looked at the corner where I was raised, where it was avocado groves, lime groves, tomato fields in our house. It was, you know, pine and palmetto forest. Well, that is now a huge boulevard with a Publix grocery store and a shopping center, you know. Where
no, is the house still there? Is the house still there?
I believe, no. The house I was raised in those periods was destroyed in Andrew. literally destroyed.
Or hurricane.
Yeah, because the my parents bought this concrete block shack and then built an addition on it. And I watched the inspectors. It was serious hurricane inspectors come by, and they'd make sure that the roof is strapped on with these steel straps that are attached on that keeps the beams attached, and a flat roof.
Wow.
And so it's intact. And then we'd put plywood sheets on the windows to protect from the hurricane. Well, what these folks did, you know, without thinking for some bloody reason, they cut holes in the ceiling and put these clear plastic domed skylights in. Well, hello. You know, when I got there, you could see what had happened. The wind had gotten into these things and flipped them out. And it had just sucked into the house and, like, gouged everything out. It blew it silly.
Wow.
And the people, somebody told me that they'd talked to them once, that they were hiding, and we had this one closet. They were hiding in the closet as their house was being blown to shit because they put these skylights in. And so I was there. The house was absolutely a wreck and abandoned. I was walking through my, house, that was destroyed. And so they tore that down.
Wow.
They tore the old house down and built a newer, nicer house farther back with a long driveway. And Eureka Drive, the road that I was raised on, apparently is the zoning limit now for this high-density residential housing that sort of crept down south from Miami like a cancer.
That's weird.
And it stops at Eureka Drive.
That's got to give you a creepy sort of feeling.
Well, where I used to go up Naranja, I used to go up Naranja Road to my buddy Robin's house. He lived by a grove up the Naranja Road. And then Jim, who lived in the middle of a squash field owned by A.J. Bryant, this farmer that I'd hang out with. And so that all is now houses with just 10 feet yards between them. And it's
crazy. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I know.
That's creepy.
So I'm going down there. I may go down there. A couple of friends in Atlanta say they want to go down with me and have a hoot. And I said, yeah, why not? And so I'm going to make a trek to Georgia and Florida, two of the more interesting states in America these days. Because Georgia politics
sort of sketchy,
amazing.
I'm telling you, it's sketchy, but it's true. You can, if you have the time, you'll have to give us a 15-20 minutes when you're on the road by the phone.
Oh, well, I did that before in Charlottesville. Yeah, of course, right, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's right. Yeah. It's a wonderful thing about this show that we do because...
On the road.
Because
You're a correspondent in South Florida.
I know it really improves the image of the show. it's not just Kansas anymore, Dorothy.
It's like Mike and the news staff here.
Well, it's not really staff because actually I did conduct an interview with Senator Tom Holland, who he was running for the office in the state house in Topeka. He's state level senator.
Okay.
And he's a prominent Democrat. He's got a great sense of humor. He's not a bad guy whatsoever.
Well, that's good.
I don't want to get any further other than to say when he was campaigning, he did call me. I called him and he said, I'm on the turnpike. I'll stop. And you can do your interview in about 5 minutes. I said, okay. So I called him back at the same number 5 minutes later, and he says, "Okay, we can do it now. I'm in the men's room."
at the rest stop.
Oh, okay. So you didn't arrest this guy. You interviewed this guy in the bathroom.
No. I don't know what's going on with these men's room talk today, but I keep going back to it. But I did an interview with him on the telephone while he was in a rest stop, and you could hear the echo. You could almost hear the porcelain. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, you know, you gotta get the interview wherever you can. You know, it's like
I guess it. Well, he did win the election, by the way. He did win. It was his first. He won the election. It was amazing.
So was this where you were running at the same time? You were running?
No. This is like this would have been like 2009 or 2010 somewhere. So this was an interesting time for sure. And we're living in an interesting time. That's why if you go to Florida, we'll have to do a show from wherever you're at.
Oh, definitely. I will give you a call from, if it works out on Tuesday, from, you know, the Publix grocery store parking lot where my house was.
Where you once lived.
Right in what used to be an avocado grove, I will... And we used to have drinking parties in the avocado groves. You know, we'd go over to Perrine and hang out.
Avocados like trees? Are they on trees or what? Avocados?
Well, you know what
like
an avocado is. Avocado are huge trees. Avocado
I know what it is, but I don't know how it grows.
Well, it grows in large trees. I mean, you know, they aren't massive trees like an oak, but they're significant trees. They're much larger than a citrus tree. Citrus trees are modest.
Oh.
But an avocado tree can be quite large, you know.
And you would drink out there in the
well,
avocado
grove. This was what you did. This is where we partied. We'd have grove parties, we called them, you know, all underage drinking, and we would go over to Perrine, which is the local town on the highway there, and the liquor store, and we'd go in the back of the liquor store, and usually there's a half a dozen black dudes over there, and we'd say one of them, here, I'll give you $5, would you go get us a quart of liquor, a cup of whiskey? Sure, absolutely.
Right.
And so we would get our liquor that way, and... And then we'd abscond to the avocado grove and you know, all sorts of
big time.
Those were the days.
Talk about the latest James Bond movie and the Aqualung.
Yeah, Aqualung. Right. But this is now a Publix grocery store and huge parking lot and it is creepy.
I mean, I retreated once and went back to my old hometown, and all the trees that I remembered are gone. It's so creepy going back to places that you have memories of, you know. The high school is much cooler than I remember.
But what it shows is when I was there in almost just north of Helmstead and the Keys from 1958 to 1965 when I joined the Army. Not a long time. It was 8 years, but it was the most critical 8 years of my life. And then, of course, I went to Vietnam, which was a critical year in my life. And so after all that, you know, trying to make sense out of it all. And so it's going to be interesting to go down there. But, what's interesting to me is that it was so rural. It was so rural and so sparsely populated at the time. You know, I went to the smallest school in Dade County, Florida, huge county with the metro government.
Right.
The smallest school with the largest Future Farmers of America outfit in, I think, the country, for God's sakes. you know, kids would learn how to grow tomatoes and squash and things like that.
This is the perfect. We got to put a pin in this one. This is a perfect ending. Overcome your war fever by retreating into your past.
There you go. Well, especially you become an old goat that, you know, you can't remember what you did 5 minutes ago, but you remember what you did 50 years ago. You know what I mean?
John Grant.
Okay. Talk to you soon, my man. Mike.